Is your financial plan set to fail miserably over the next decade? It could be. We're going to talk about that on the show coming up today.
From the streets of San Antonio straight to your wallet, it's Jake's 2 cents on Jake of All Trades.
All right, welcome back. My name is Kirk Barbera, and I'm not a financial expert.
And I'm Jake Rivas. I am a financial expert, but together, Kirk and I review financial planning topics, talk about the economy, and review financial articles, all with the express purpose of helping our listeners build wealth both today and into the future.
And we have a super positive one today. Most financial plans set to fail miserably over the next decade. Woo!
That article struck me big time. I was like, ouch.
Yeah, and sometimes it's important to kind of, you know, look at the reality, not just positives and saying that everything's honky-dory. I mean, obviously, we've talked a lot about negatives. 2020 has been the negative year, and a lot of people, I think, at the end of the year are trying something positive, but we need to, I guess, always keep an eye on reality and make sure that we understand where things are going and that there are a lot of worries to have in the future. Yeah. If we're being honest with ourselves. So what is this article? Very short article. I'll just pop it up for a second. It's on Seeking Alpha, right? So
yeah, it's kind of a technical financial investor website, but I really thought that the context was important for us to talk about. Because like you said, 2020 has been the negative year, right? But we have this mismatch in the financial markets where we've seen this tremendous amount of outperformance with specific investments, specifically technology stocks.
Yes.
And we talked about earlier in the year, you know, the rise of people using smartphone apps to do market trading and buying stocks. Yeah. And so there has certainly been like kind of this false narrative that's permeated through investors' minds when they look at the performance of their portfolios this year. And so what this article is speaking to is like, all right, we saw this extraordinary, unprecedented plunge in stock prices in February and March of this year. Fastest drawdown in U.S. financial market history. Mm-hmm. And then the subsequent rebound of those equity prices was the fastest rebound in U.S. history. So we broke two barriers this year. But when you look at the composition of that rebound and it being at only a handful of technology stocks, what this article is suggesting is that's creating a false sense of optimism when investors and clients are constructing their financial plans for long-term growth projections. So I'll give you an example. When I put together a financial plan for someone, if I'm making a recommendation for them saving for retirement, for example, I have to make an educated guess on how their assets might grow over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And this type of a market environment where we're seeing double-digit performance in a lot of different securities can affect how an everyday investor projects their retirement success into the future. So instead of planning a conservative growth rate of 5 or 6% on their investments, now they've seen this huge run in performance in their portfolios. And so they may adjust those expectations to be twice that level of growth. And the risk of doing that is that you're setting yourself up for failure in the future if you don't meet those investment assumptions.
Yeah, so you're making plans based on unrealistic projections.
Right.
So like if you think you're going to get 10% when really you're going to get 4 or 5% on your money, that's a big change. And it changes your behavior today as well, because you think you can maybe invest a little less of your money, which means you could spend a little bit more on some frivolities that you would normally save and put into an investment account. You say, well, you know, I'm going to get 10%. So why don't I live a little now more than I planned on based on my, you know, these projections. And now is this something that financial advisors are talking to each other about and making legitimate advice, or are there advisors out there giving the advice of, you know, not looking properly at this data and saying that, Yeah, I mean, we could be 7%, even though it's probably 5 or something.
That's a good question. I don't know. I know for like our practice, we always err on the side of caution anyway, because this type of a market environment that we've experienced this year is an anomaly and should not be taken into consideration when you're making more longer term projections. And so I would hope that other advisors are kind of following along those same lines. I will say too, another big thing amongst advisors in the industry is the need to be forward thinking in your investment ideas and opportunities. So historically, we might just be, you know, investing in the stock market, investing in consumer companies, grocery stores, you know, tech companies. But now, given this high concentration in tech stocks, it's becoming more apparent that as an investor, in order to properly diversify, you need to start looking for more opportunistic ideas. Maybe I'm just giving these out. This is not a recommendation. I'm just saying these off the top of my head. But maybe you look into like a solar energy investment, mm-hmm. or, you know, something to do with SpaceX, or maybe it's robotics, self-driving cars, some industry or some sector or some technology that diversifies your portfolio away a little bit from some of these really large stake corporations that the majority of the market is now made up of.
Yeah, that's the FANG thing that we talked about, right?
FANG.
Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix,
Google, Microsoft, and...
Oh, FANG. FANG.
Microsoft and app. Did we say Apple?
We said Apple. Yeah, it's two A's in
those there. Those are the ones. Yeah. Those are the guys that have been running the market rampant this year, which is great. It's been great for portfolios. But the other important aspect of this article too, that the author points out, is when you look back historically and you look at periods of time where the financial markets corrected or dropped in value significantly, kind of like they did this year. Many times that drop is due to a true fundamental undervaluation of those stocks. So they're on sale. Like they're truly on sale. It's a good bargain.
Right now they're on sale.
A company. No, I'm saying historically when we've had these types of market corrections, yeah. It's an opportunity for investors to buy into the financial markets because stuff is truly on sale.
Yeah, like the market.
Make sense?
Yeah, company valuations go down probably because it's more realistic than what it was before, right? Like they were kind of overvalued based on factors like government intervention or government stimulus or something, right? That props them up. And so when they correct and they go down, that's a good opportunity if you have the capital to buy those sale products, which, you know, I don't remember who it was that said it, but some economist said like, there's no such thing as a loss in the American economy. It's just a transfer of wealth in a sense. So like people who have capital during those downtimes, they're able to get in on that level. But the people who just had it, who are, because they're buying it from people, right? Like a month ago, it was, you know, like their paper, what's it called? Their on paper wealth was 5 times what it is right now. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, oh no, I'm scared. So they get out and they sell it. And then of course, people with capital are the ones who are buying it. And sometimes those people with capitals are not in America. They could be in China or in other countries.
Absolutely.
That just happen to have wealth that, you know, capital at that time.
Capital to be able to acquire those assets. Yep. At a deeply discounted value.
Yeah.
The problem though, is that 2020, when we had that same scenario play out in February and March, we saw it happen. Investors with capital flooded the markets and now they started to buy up all the tech stocks, right?
Yeah.
The problem though, was that the genesis of that decline wasn't an overvalued environment. It was COVID and the pandemic, right? Historically, when we've had that same magnitude of a decline in equity prices, it's usually because they are overvalued. And so now when I buy them, it's not because of some external pandemic. It's just because the natural business cycle. So when I acquire those assets, I'm acquiring them at an undervalued price that reflects the true earnings and growth of the company. Now for 2020, if you're that investor that poured a lot of capital in to acquire these assets, they were still expensive from historical valuation perspective. So this article is suggesting that this is a different environment, and now you can't bank on a 10-year return, strong positive return on those assets, because you didn't buy them to begin with at the same undervalued levels that you should have.
So let's compare it to, he talks about the roaring 20s. Mm-hmm. And so he makes a point of those hoping that the market plunge between February and March was enough to launch the next secular expansion in stock prices overlook a mountain of historical evidence. And then he talks about the roaring 20s. And here's just one important takeaway. Let's also not forget the singular most important fact. Our history's previous secular bull markets, this is what you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. Grew from extreme undervaluations, washed out. So how can we, such was not the case over the last decade, as the Federal Reserve and government have pumped more than $36 trillion into the economy to keep it afloat. So I want to try to have like a clear comparison between the roaring 20s, which is one historical mm-hmm. example of this, and today. I mean, to some yeah. degree, I think it feels, you know, if you know anything about the roaring 20s, there was a kind of, from 2010 to 2020, that feel where it was kind of like the roaring 20s in a sense, right? From companies, from a market perspective, everything was just up and up and up, and it seemed like there was no ceiling. And even you and I were talking about like, there's got to be a ceiling at some point. And then of course, yeah. COVID hit, and that like really revealed a lot of the problems, and it was a bigger crash even than 2008, I believe, and at yes. least economically. And well, it was, yeah. you know, recession. So the question is, he's saying in this article that there's a difference between the roaring 20s and today. And so mm-hmm. in the roaring 20s, there was, you know, after World War One, there was a lot of optimism. There was money going into the market. I don't know how, I'm not an expert on that era, so I'm trying to do what I remember from economics class back in college and high school. And it's like, and I remember, you know, it's they just like today, there was a stock market. But then, of course, in 29, the crash happened. And this is uh-huh. what some people say is the impetus for the Great Depression. So at that time, though, there were people who were able to buy into the market when it crashed. That's kind of what they're saying here.
Right.
The difference today is that the market, I'm just kind of like reiterating as much as I understand of this. Hopefully this helps the listener reiterate in their own mind what's going on. So the difference is between 2010 and 20 versus 1919 and 1929 is that our government today has pumped in $36 trillion into the economy, which has kind of made it somewhat artificially afloat, which yeah. did not happen from 1919 to 1929. Right. So the crash was a real crash back then.
Right.
This crash is a manufactured crash, or what's, so this is where I'm confused. Like, what exactly are the differences, and what does that mean for the future? Right.
Sure. So yeah. So the crash in the 20s wasn't not that is an interesting way to put it, because if you think about, so in the 20s, it was a true like economic collapse, right? And when that occurred, I don't know what the genesis was, because I'm not an expert on that time period in history, but I know that that was during the Great Depression or just post Great Depression.
Well, the Great Depression was the 30s.
The 30s. So
it happened right afterwards.
Great Depression. Yeah. Right. But that crash wasn't due to the housing market collapsing like it happened in 2008. And it also wasn't due to a pandemic like what happened in 2020. So those two crashes, the most recent ones we've had, were created by external factors that weren't tied to the fundamentals of the stocks that we were buying and growing and trying to work to grow with. Whereas in the 20s, that's what happened, right? It was an economic collapse. These two collapses, the most recent ones have been completely different. And then also the offsetting effect was the government intervened to bring the economy back to a more sustainable level. And they did that by just injecting tons and tons of cash into the economy in the form of stimulus. Like you said, $36 trillion. So there's a shift, a monumental shift of so much more liquidity flooding the markets than there was back in the 20s.
Well, I don't know about the 20s. I know in the 30s, this is when we get the welfare state. So there was a kind of, this is FDR's great plan. This is, mm-hmm. so they injected into the economy that, money that way. And we had a whole reshaping of the economy in terms of, this is when we get, I think things like, one, the welfare state itself, where it's like you get Social Security and that's where these types of programs start to happen. I guess what I'm confused though is I'm still a little unsure of what this implies about the future in general. So I know specifically there's something that this article talks about that you talked about earlier about being weary of making your financial plan about this, roaring tens that we just had.
Yeah.
Right. Because a lot of it is fake and I think, or at least manufactured and somewhat artificial. And I mean, I think like a practical thing of what that means is the something we've talked about before with these zombie companies, where some of these companies are not really producing much value, but they were able to get an influx of cash from the government, from stimulus. And so they were able to continue operating, even though they're not. And I think some like airlines were like that, where they were, a lot of them were empty. They weren't really, the airplanes themselves within this company was not doing well, but they were able to sustain themselves through government intervention.
Right.
Which means that they're not really producing. So if you're invested in that company, you're invested in a company that's actually staying afloat because a third party, the government, gave them money. Right.
Right.
And they're part of that, the inflation, not inflation exactly, but the propping up of a lot of companies like that.
Right. So the difference, I think, just as you alluded to, so if there's government intervention to some extent in the 20s, right, in the form of a welfare plan, that money is not going into the financial markets, right? Because that's going to
and that's in the 30s.
The 30s. So that money's not going into the financial markets to buy stocks. No. Now, in 2008, 2009, who got bailed out by the stimulus? Big banks and corporations.
Yeah.
That money flowed right back into the financial markets, right?
Yeah.
And then in 2020, we get stimulus passed and it goes again to corporations. And we know based on the data that a lot of them used that to do share buybacks in the marketplace, which increases their share price. So the difference here is that the government's intervention more heavily skewed in recent times to flow into financial assets like stocks, whereas it hasn't done that historically. And so that creates a problem because now your asset levels become extremely overvalued because you just had so much more liquidity injected in there, but you can tie a significant chunk of it to government intervention. So how long is that sustainable?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of weird and, to try to figure out what that means, because from a political standpoint, it makes me think like in the 30s, we tried these social programs to fix the problem that was that happened in the 20s, right? Like the overvaluation, I don't know enough about it either to know all the details. It's something we should talk about in the future. Might be worthwhile to study because it seems like there are comparisons between those two, that decade and our decade now, because the 30s, the solution was socialism essentially, right? Social security.
That's where we got social security,
unemployment,
Medicare,
Medicaid. Well, I think Medicaid might've come later, but
those
types of programs of, we will take care of you, the people. Now in today's world, so that was socialism that we tried under FDR in the 30s. and that, you know, stayed with us, and we have those social programs in the welfare state. Today, it, you know, I hate to say it, but if you know the definition politically, we're trying fascist programs. And fascism, you know, is the marriage between government and corporations. It's when that's the definition in political theory of fascism, is governments having control over corporations, essentially, or right, not complete control. So there's still like a kind of freedom within governments. And this actually
I was just going to say like significant influence,
but they have significant influence. And when you think about it, they've been spending this $36 trillion into corporations, and there's already politicians talking about how there needs to be more, like how the government, Obama talked about this, how the government has to actually be a shareholder, a stockholder with a voice. That's fascism. That's the definition of fascism. So what I'm saying is, like, you know, it's interesting. I wonder if anybody's connected this, that there is socialism that we tried in the 30s that we still live with. And we don't have full socialism. We have a mixed economy of social programs and non-social. And now we have kind of like, it seems like a fascist perspective of the government kind of being a voice within corporate stakeholders. And you see a lot of this where they're trying to, you know, the things that we talked about where it's like, what is it? Where like all the race training that like Trump has said he's not going to do with the government. This is something that politicians have said they want to make a requirement of corporations to have, right?
Oh, like racial sensitivity training.
Yeah, and diversity training and all these types of trainings, you know, that, but the, whatever you think of those, the point is that if it's done from the government, right, like where they're dictating that has to happen, and then there's like that top-down corporate aspect to it, that's fascism, right? That, like, having the marriage between government, having government be a voice on corporate boards, right? Like, just imagine a corporate board today is made up of the stakeholders, and their job, legally, the job of a corporation is to the shareholders financially, right? So when they make decisions legally, and, you know, this is fiscal law, they are supposed to make decisions with the shareholders in mind. But if we shift that and we say, and we change the law up, which I think is happening because, again, this $36 trillion into the economy during this time is giving the government an argument to say, hey, we gave you all this money, right? And now we need to be a part of your board. And I mean, I think it's an interesting, I mean, I could be wrong about all of this in terms of what our future has, but I has in store for us, but I wonder if having government bureaucrats on the board making decisions might be part of it, of the future, which, you know, again, when you think about, we had the 30s, we had socialism, those ramifications, you know, wonder what it will be for our 20s and the, you know, that kind of social, that kind of marriage between.
Like, right.
So,
yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if I went back just to tack on your point about like diversity training and that coming down as a requirement from the government, right? That should, though, if you think about it, we have labor laws that are set by the government. And if you think about the reason that's being incorporated, there's a reason it is. So clearly it's not being done. So while I get your point about government intervention at a board level and being able to control, you know, forcing diversity training, that wouldn't be any different than forcing employers to give you an hour break every 8 hours something like that. You know what I mean? So I feel like you have to have some degree of that. Now, when it comes to the financial aspects, that's where I agree with you. Now, the problem, though, is that, like, let's take this last round of stimulus that the federal government issued out, the PPP program, and there's small business loans, all sorts of things. The stipulation, though, to the corporation was nil. It was basically like, this is the money you get, and you get to use it how you see fit. Yeah. And then the outcome was, now we have these major corporations that went and bought back their shares in the marketplace instead of using that money for something else.
Yeah.
So how do you fix that dynamic is a question. And I think that what this article is pointing to is, regardless of whether or not you fix that, the reality is that the liquidity has already been placed and is in the system. And so if the financial markets, let me think of how to phrase this, with the liquidity being in the system at this magnitude and the destination that it went to, right? A lot of it went to financial assets, financial market assets. This article is speaking to the fact that that cannot be sustainable long-term unless, right, this is where now I'm getting into my own thesis, you get more government intervention, more liquidity to continually prop up asset prices. So this article doesn't acknowledge that piece of it, which it seems like historically that's what the government's been doing, and that's probably what they're going to keep doing moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's what they have to do because of the earlier actions they've taken. And I think we're saying the same thing, though, is that for me, the future is going to be they're going to put strings to it, which they haven't in the past.
Gotcha.
Right. So yes, they're going to continue it, but at some point they're going to say, well, look, we need it to be under these auspices. So we're going to put these strings to it. In the past, it was like, here, we're going to give Ford, you know, $50 billion or whatever it is. So because they're too big to fail and they're going to bail out this, you know, which is just a weird company to bail out, but they thought that there are too many jobs. So instead of the government paying directly to the, you know, like unemployment or whatever, like they might've in the 30s more, they paid, you know, because they valued jobs, right? They said that jobs, we have to have jobs. You know, we have to have Americans working. Working is a value in and of itself, even if you're just digging ditches, which is a weird, you know, that's kind of what we're seeing, though, is that a lot of these companies are zombie companies and they're not producing real value. And that's kind of my point, is they're essentially digging ditches. So it's not that different than it was under just getting unemployment and just buying stuff, you know, with that money, whether it's, you know, food, rent, and other things possibly. And so in the future, my thesis is that we're going to have, like you're saying, continued buying of these companies to give them extra market capital, but the government's going to start telling them what to do more, right? Mm-hmm. And saying you have to institute this program, you have to have this amount of financial reserves. Right. So we can't have you crashing like this. So you're required to, which has all kinds of ramifications in terms of how many people they can hire in the future. Right. If they have to have a certain amount of treasure trove and they're a thin margined company. Right. Mm-hmm. This outside of like FANG, those financial or those tech companies, the major ones, a lot of companies are not that don't have that kind of margin on their profits.
Oh, right.
I just think there's a lot of,
I mean, most don't.
Most don't. Yeah. That's very unusual to, or the, you know, crazy to the tech world that they have that. Mm-hmm. So I guess to bring it back to, planning for your personal finances, the world we live in is a shaky one. This article here is talking about, you know, plan for lower, you know, plan for a lot lower in terms of what, you know, be very conservative. And I think one conclusion from our conversation in this piece is that, I think you're right that the government will continue to vet out some money to corporations. Mm-hmm. So you're probably not going to get like, you know, a 2% return or 1%. You probably will be able to rely on some decent return. Mm-hmm. You know, on your money, but it'll be less than it was in the future. And, but I think the question is going to be how much, overall economic growth is possible in this new world.
Yeah.
And for me, I think that like I'm talking about real economic growth.
Right. And we're not talking about just, you're not talking about just the financial markets. You're talking about
actually growing the economy, more buildings. More
than the 3 or 4% that we've been averaging for the last decade.
And this is something I've said in the past. I think we're going to be more around like 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've said this before, but I think there's the difference between 1 and 3 and 4% is like the difference between, you know, if you go back in time and you go back to like 1890 to 1960, and we went from we had no cars to going to the moon. Like that's 3 or 4% growth. That's what 4% growth looks like today. You know, if we had that 3 or 4% growth, we could be going from going to the moon to going to Mars, right? And to having life expectancy increased by 100 years, right? We could have de-aging medicine. We could have things that are just phenomenal biotech things that we can't even fathom at this point that are not going to happen. And that is what I don't like, is that our lives, that we can't see what doesn't exist because of economic stagnation.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
I could see that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that it's that, you know, and I think when you look at that 3% that we're going to lose, that 3% is the difference between you and I living to 150 and, you know, living to 85 or 90, like everybody else has always
done. I don't know that I want to live to 150.
I would love to live to 150. Healthily.
Health. Okay.
Yeah. That's what biotech is all about, is like, they're putting money, or they want to put more money into de-aging, right? So that you look 50, even when you're 100, right? Yeah. Like let's imagine something like that. Like that'd be phenomenal. And that's possible.
Right. But not when we can't.
Not grow. With stagnation. Yeah. Right. Because there's like that type of thing takes a lot of capital without any guarantee of a return. Right. It's the same thing with like why we have this tech boom, is that there was huge amounts of capital put into fiber optics and laying all the groundwork in the 80s and 90s that we are benefiting from today. I mean, trillions of dollars put into that infrastructure. That kind of infrastructure needs to happen in biotech and in space exploration. That's what Musk and some of these guys are doing, but they're only doing with a little bit of their extra wealth. It's not like a systemic, you know, like the whole economy putting into that wealth or into that segment, you know, trillions of dollars. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I do think, though, if you look at the balance sheet of these major tech companies, they collectively, the fangs, are their market capitalization is larger than all of the market indices in the world, with the exception of the US and Japan. So they definitely have a ton of cash and resources. So it could be interesting to see, like, okay, we have some capacity there for some of this major growth. The question then will be, you know, how much is it limited by government and this narrative about big tech being bad? But I don't want to go on that tangent really, but because the point of this is we're talking about the stock prices really. Yeah. So just the stock prices having a reversion to the mean over the next 10 years seems plausible. And the starting point where we're at right now is fundamentally a lot higher than it was historically. So it seems to be within reason that a major correction or low, slow growth for the long term, at least as it relates to financial assets, is probably pretty likely.
Yeah.
So the practical takeaways from a planning standpoint, rebalance. So, you know, all of you listening, everyday investors, we can't control any of this. So really all we're looking at is data and trying to make an assumption, kind of create a thesis for ourselves.
Yeah.
But we know, tried and true, that looking at your asset allocation at the end of the year, especially a year like this, and rebalancing. So taking some gains on some stuff that's done really well and moving it around into some other asset classes or sectors that don't look as attractive right now is a good strategy to take in the very short term. And then also being opportunistic in your investment, you know, thesis moving forward, finding some different asset classes or some different industries to also invest your money so that you're just diversified and well prepared for whatever the heck is going to happen in
like
the future.
Like SpaceX or space.
Like SpaceX, yeah.
Or biotech.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not making a recommendation.
No. Oh, yeah, no, definitely not. Not SpaceX specifically. Yeah. But you're just saying that type of something like that outside of the normal
forward thinking. Yeah,
because it's something to consider as part of
your overall.
So strategy. Don't go crazy with it.
Yeah,
and that's something you have to figure out with your financial advisor.
Yep. Bingo.
Yeah, I like it.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Jake of All Trades. Be sure to check us out on social media by searching for @Jake's2Cents. Check out the blog at jakes2cents.com. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor. Fixed insurance products and services offered through CES Insurance Agency. Actual performance and results will vary. These interviews do not constitute a recommendation as to the suitability of any investment for any person or persons having circumstances similar to those portrayed. Consult a financial advisor regarding your specific circumstances.